Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Author Carson Medley was a Division II basketball tourist for a year and wrote a book about this behind-the-scenes journey that gives a glimpse into the hearts of 15 young men, three coaches, three managers, a trainer, and a cast of small-town characters. Carson Medley, welcome.
Thank you. It's surreal to be here and dreamlike, actually.
Surreal, huh?
Surreal. My five-year-old son, Holden, and I were talking about you last night and how Daddy was going to be on the radio, and he was really excited. He loves NSPR.
At 5 years old?
It's his mother, yes.
Oh, my goodness. Right. Well, that's good news.
Thank you.
Now, you've written a book about basketball, and there, not everybody knows about basketball, is interested in basketball. So how do you present your book to the non-basketball fan?
Yeah, great question. When I decided to write this book, my wife, who isn't a huge basketball fan either, kept asking me who in the world would want to read a book about college basketball, particularly at the Division II level. So with basketball, it's something that I've been a part of for, 37 years now, and I always saw it as a metaphor for the struggle that everybody goes through in life, the sports metaphor. And I wanted to write something that actually transcended basketball because I had seen something very special with this coach and this team that I thought could transfer to a classroom, that could transfer to any educational system, to a boardroom, to parents helping their kids. I just saw pure leadership. And I thought basketball was my portal into that metaphorical journey.
So on the one hand, a natural group that you're writing for are basketball fans,
right,
and particularly ones that are familiar with the program at Chico State University. But you also have written a story of a person who inspires others. He happens to be a basketball coach, but
yes,
he could be have any career, profession, because he is such an inspiring leader.
Right. Yeah, so I think when I first met Coach Klink, I don't know if you recall, but there was a lot of people at the university probably about, 3 years ago, there was a vote of no confidence and there was low staff morale. People weren't very happy. And right about the same time, I started playing basketball with this group of men in Shermer Gym, and I met Coach Klink. And then I kind of got to know him and I got interested in his program, and we, kind of became friends, and I saw that his team was winning so much and got to know him a little bit better. And I wanted to figure out, what is this little bitty program doing so well that it seems like so many other people on not only the campus but in the world are struggling with? So I had to pop the hood and look into that engine and see what was going on and if, in fact, there was something going on. And that's when I pitched my idea to him for the book.
Well, I'd also like to know what experience you bring to being a writer and writing this book in particular. But because you, I mentioned that you grew up in Mississippi, you were born in Mississippi, and that may surprise people because you don't sound like you grew up in the South. But what were your experiences? How did you get from Mississippi to California, for example?
Oh, let's see. I believe it was Mark Twain that said not to let schooling interfere with your education. And at the same time, I was reading Jack Kerouac, and he said, go on the road. So I did. As you mentioned, in high school, I had the pleasure of throwing Eudora Welty's paper. I had no idea who she was, really, at the time. It's another long story.
William Faulkner country?
Yeah, I was born in Oxford, Mississippi. And Willie Morris, who actually wrote a book that inspired this called The Courting of Marcus Dupree, who was the first ever highly recruited college football player out of Neshoba County, Mississippi, where you might recall, I believe it was in 1964, the three Jewish kids were murdered. A lot of really bad things happened there, but this player, Marcus Dupree, he sort of united race relations through sports in Mississippi, and I believe it was 1978. So anyway, I grew up around a lot of Southern writers, and I was going to the University of Mississippi for a year, and I was so disillusioned by what I was seeing. And I would literally go to Faulkner's grave like once a week, and I would just sit there and I would write terrible poetry. And I would meet never hung out with him, but I would sort of be on the periphery of Willie Morris at a bar in Oxford, Mississippi, and all these great Southern writers. And I got out of Mississippi, and I had a van. I had a Golden Retriever. I moved to Colorado, lived in Vail and Telluride, and then I traveled to Greece or to Europe, ended up in Greece selling capuzzis, watermelons, for 5 months, wrote even worse poetry. But
you were on the road, Jack Kerouac recommended.
I was on the road, and I was reading a lot of Henry Miller, and I was just learning how I thought I knew how to write. And then I came back home, went to community college, transferred to Berkeley, and I got a paper back. And it was basically telling me I was the worst writer in the world. Yeah.
Oh, my.
So you asked a question about this particular basketball team, and I kind of was explaining how I got the idea about, you know, on my campus there was turmoil, but there was this program that was winning. But deeper than that, what I discovered is that I've always been a Division II writer, meaning a lot of the players that I, all 15 of the guys and the coaches and the managers that I cover in the book, were overlooked. They were good in high school, but they might have been 3 inches too short, 35 pounds too light. And as a writer that really struggled for 20 years, but honestly, I've done it every day of my life for 20 years. So many close calls, so many unpublished work, so many, hey, your screenplay looks great, we're interested, and then at the last minute they drop it. I could relate to these 18 to 22-year-old men. And that is the basketball metaphor, if that makes sense.
My guest is Carson Medley, and he has written a basketball book called Through the Red Door. And when you came to California, I noticed that you don't have much of a Southern accent now, but so people might not have known that you were from Mississippi. When they found that out, did you run into perhaps Californians having a stereotype of what somebody from Mississippi would think?
Yeah, it was awful. Going to Berkeley, you know, as a 21, 22-year-old, actually I was 23, was very difficult because, you know, I would tell people I was from Mississippi and I still had a thick accent at the time. And, you know, it was, you know, kind of your... I don't know, I was sort of stereotyped. I sounded dumb. You know, I wasn't, you know, I didn't have the world's greatest education in high school growing up, and I had a lot to learn, and I never felt like I was one of the smartest, but somehow I was there. And I felt like I kind of had to prove myself. So along the way, I kind of like William Faulkner, how he sort of adapted all of these different personalities, like he'd been in the Royal Air Force and had a cane and a hat. You know, I was really in this stage of reinventing myself. And you know, one of my favorite writers said that, you know, the great thing about writing is you get to be the hero of your own. Beep. So that's kind of also, I think, how I really got into writing was that feeling of insecurity at being a Southerner at a prestigious Northern California school.
In fact, in your book, there's a sentence in your book where you say, I don't love writing.
Yeah.
You know, you only write because you do it to keep from going crazy.
Yeah. And no, it's funny because another reason why this book resonated so well with me is, as you'll discover with Coach Klink, not to let the cat out of the wildcat, nice pun, those writers. But one of the things that you'll discover about Coach Klink that I didn't know going into this is that games make him sick and nauseated. He hates them. He loves practice, but he hates games. And I lose his weight and get sick. It's the same thing with writing for me. It's not something that... I don't so much enjoy it. I enjoy like the writing part, but I don't enjoy the book that you're reading in your hands now, because as I pointed out in my, there will be imperfections, you know, and it kind of makes me sick. And I promised my wife this is the last book that I would write, bless her heart, because she's had to deal with, you know, so many different genres that I've dabbled in. But this is the first book in my life, and I've written a lot that I never wrote. Samuel Johnson said that a writer should, only a fool writes for anything but money. And I thought, you know, I was like, I need to write this screenplay on Marilyn Monroe, or I need to write a Western genre that's set in space because it'll sell money. And this was the first thing that I've ever written in 20 years that I didn't care if it made a dime. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Because it was real. And
so that's interesting that you and Coach Klink seem to share that something he loves. I mean, he obviously loves basketball, yeah. And yet it makes him sick. And you, here you
the
are writing.
The games make him sick, yeah.
Okay, take it back. And yet you say that you don't love writing. You love basketball,
yeah.
But you don't love writing. So you understand what he goes through in some sense, don't you?
And that was the connection, I think, between he and I. That was the great discovery.
Well, maybe that gives hope to people listening who love something, but it's very stressful for them.
Yes. Well, that's the metaphor of the red door, is because what you'll read about and what you can come and see in his practices is there's the red door that the young men and the coaches walk through.
In fact, that's the cover of your book. You might describe the cover of your book.
Yeah, so the cover of my book even was sort of has grassroots. I pulled the sports information director, Luke Reed, down the hall and I said, get your camera fast. I finally figured out what the cover needs to be. So we had a player's shoes. I had my school books with me, the ball, and we just took shots of the red door. And the red door is blemished, and it's dirty and greasy. And my wife even said, God, that door's awful. Who's
going to want to? You should have cleaned it. You should have cleaned that door, Carson.
Who wants to walk through that door? And that metaphor of the red door is when it's closed, I dedicated the book to people that do things day in and day out behind closed doors. And I love that part of, that part of writing is a lot of fun. I mean, really, but it's the am I going to win? Am I going to reach the 500, as Coach Klink talks about? Do you know what I mean?
And
it makes me vulnerable.
That this door on the cover of your book is not closed. You
right.
can see through the door to a gym.
Yeah, and it's funny you bring
a basketball court.
A basketball court. And it was going to be called Through the Red Door and Beyond.
I remember that was the original title.
That was the original title. But my wife and my family and I, we went to Roseville, went to Macy's, and I tried out the title on people. And they're like, Through the Red Door and what?
Did a little testing on that. Now, so down at the bottom on the cover, you have kind of a dirty basketball and some shoes, a stack of books.
Yep.
And why did you include the books? Because this is about basketball. I can see the basketball, the shoes. Why did you put books in that photograph, Carson?
As my Southern mother would say, bless your heart for asking that question. Because this will give me my chance. So one of the other pieces that I'm really interested in is our student athletes. I wrote this book also at a time when I got really sick of the one-and-done college freshman sensation, Division I, going off to the pros and making lots of money. And what I noticed and what I wanted to study with Coach Klink's program and what I discovered is that his players have high 80% graduation rates. Division II basketball players coming in as freshmen have a 46% graduation rate. And I had to figure out, okay, these guys aren't going to play in, they're not going to play in the NBA. A couple might play in Europe, but they're graduating from college. And a lot of them are first-generation college students. You'll read a lot of them don't have father figures, and they all talk about their moms, every one of them, and family. And they're young men that are playing a game at a really high level. You know, they're one of the best teams in Division II in the country. We play the University of Arizona. We almost beat Stanford. And our guys have higher graduation rates. So that's why I wanted to throw the books in there, because I can say...
Into the photograph.
Yeah. Because this book is also about these guys that are really student athletes.
And that's thanks to Coach Klink.
Yeah, I think it's thanks to Coach Klink, and it's thanks to the guys' parents that he recruits. And what I discovered in the book is he can actually sit down and I asked the players this, he can sit down and look at their mom and dad and grandma in the eye and say, I can't promise you that your son's going to play right away. He's going to redshirt. But within 5 years, he's going to get a college degree. And it happens. And I was so inspired by that,
Well,
that's
the
story.
You just brought up a term, red shirt, and people may have kind of a vague idea of what red shirting is.
Yes.
But would you explain that to those of us who may not be familiar with basketball?
Yeah, definitely. So lore has it that it started at the University of Nebraska way back when a guy got injured and they said put a red shirt on him so he could sit out the year. So the NCAA doesn't actually use the language red shirt freshman, but what red shirt means is... let's take Coach Klink's players, for example. We have 17 and 18 young men who physically and athletically might be ready to perform at a high level, but there might be something academically or emotionally or socially where they need to take a year off. So rather than taking a guy like Justin Briggs, who's profiled in the book, who's a 6'9 star, could have started for anyone right away, he sits him down and says, you know what, you're great, but we're going to redshirt you and you're going to wait 16 months before you can play. So essentially, the reason he does it, there's a lot of red shirts for like if you get hurt. So essentially what it means is that you come in and as a freshman, you get to go to practice. You know, you go to team meetings. You don't travel with the team and you never get to play an official game. You're part of the team, but he does it, Coach Klink does it in a way that it gives them a year to, and what I'm studying right now is to work on their identity development, their social development, emotional development, academics, and athletic development. So that's what I figured out why he does it, and all of the guys in the book, except for one or two, were redshirted.
Yeah, in fact, that's the exception is for Coach Klink not to redshirt one of his players.
Exactly, and only one player on the current team, Jalen McFerrin, did not redshirt.
I remember.
Crazy, right? Yeah.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with author Carson Medley. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Carson Medley, whose book, Through the Red Door, follows Division II basketball at Chico State University. So Coach Klink is passionate about the game, but he really cares for his players, and that is shown up because the relationship continues. You mentioned that some of these guys do not have father figures in their lives, and long after they play for him, they love him.
Yes.
And they come back, him and his wife.
Yeah.
And speaking of his wife, you know, basketball is kind of a guy's thing, if I want to put it that way. And there's a part of the book that I think will touch women's hearts.
Oh, good.
And that is the story of how he and his wife met.
Mm, yes.
So tell us that story.
Oh, goodness. Oh, boy. I'm scared I'll get the linear version when I should be telling the non-linear version. You'll just have to read about it in her chapter. Okay. So basically, let me think if I get it right. She was at a Super Bowl party.
So here comes this guy with some snacks that he didn't prepare. His mother prepared them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So she sees this handsome young
coach. Did you give her name?
Yes, Courtney.
Okay.
And she makes and sells wonderful jewelry.
Now,
yes.
But this, they were young,
not
and
then.
She didn't even know she had this talent for making jewelry.
It wasn't discovered yet.
So she comes into this party.
Yeah, and she hears that this young basketball assistant coach is coming by, and she sees Greg walking by with a big platter of food that she later finds out that his mom made for him and brought. So she goes back that night to where she was working, I believe it was Chili's, and waitressing, and told all of her friends, I met the guy I'm going to marry. He's mine. And she asked him out on a date. And that's how it worked out.
Now, originally then, her interest in meeting somebody was because he was at Davis, UC Davis.
Yes. Right?
And she wanted to go there to school.
Exactly.
And I thought it was interesting that she goes there and he ends up leaving.
Yeah.
So they had this long-distance relationship.
Yep. Yeah, it was a long distance relationship that it worked, and getting to know both of them together was a really interesting surprise too, because as I mentioned in the book, growing up in the South, I had stereotyped coaches' wives, you know, cleat chasers, and you know, just well, you were in the South, you know how it was, and meeting Courtney, that was one of the first questions I asked her. I'm like, so what is it like being a coach's wife? You know, and she just told me straight up, you know, it's nothing like I had imagined. And that was the beauty of this book, is everything that I thought I knew, I realized I didn't know, you know?
So we might fast forward. It was several years went by before they got married.
Yeah.
And then they come to Chico, and she has a career, and she does not use his last name. So people, because Klink is a rather unusual name.
Right.
But since she doesn't use that last name, there are people who interact with her as her business of creating jewelry, and they don't even know that she's the coach's wife.
Right, and she doesn't tell them. She'll have friends for a long time that will finally say, "Oh, wait, you're the basketball coach's wife?" And that's what drew me to this story. And what's so cool about that family is they don't throw their name around town. You know, like in the South, saying you're the coach's wife might get you a free meal somewhere. But yeah, and I've also found it interesting that metaphorically that, you know, he would marry a glassblower. You know, there's so many connections there. But yeah.
Well, she wasn't doing that when they met.
Right.
She rather discovered, how did she discover that she had a talent for making jewelry?
Oh, goodness. I think the chapter will tell a little bit more, but I believe she and her mother she said she was bored and she was looking for something to do while she was in school. So her and her mom started taking, I believe, a glass blowing class. Courtney, I'm sorry if I got that wrong. But she always had a love for old ashtrays, she told me, when she and her
glass
mom.
Glass ones.
Yeah, glass ashtrays. And she just started making this beautiful jewelry. And I think that it's great because she, you know, they're both very intense people, but she told me that she's more intense than he is.
Which is hard to believe.
Which is hard to believe.
What he's like.
And see, I'd never seen what I call the corny side of Coach Klink because I didn't want to see that side. But she's like, no, he actually is a fun guy. When he comes home, he doesn't talk about basketball unless we want to talk about it.
Yeah,
I thought that was refreshing.
And when he comes home, he's the dad and the husband. He's not the basketball coach when he comes home.
Yeah, exactly.
And you didn't even know he played guitar until she told you, right?
I had no idea because there's a side of him that I was hoping that would emerge. But to get information out of him was really, really hard.
Because she says he's not a talker.
He doesn't. He won't tell you. But if you ask him for something, what I learned is he'll give you whatever you ask for, but nothing more. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. And that was refreshing to see someone that was real and transparent.
My guest is Carson Medley, and his book is Through the Red Door. It's a story of the basketball team at Chico State University. And he spent a year observing the team, going to their meetings and watching the films. What was your relationship with the team when you started this project?
Oh, that was interesting. So my relationship with the team, so I remember meeting them. It was in a March, right after their season had ended. And, you know, Coach Klink said, "Hey, this is Carson. He's going to follow us around next year and write a book." And they're, you know, kind of like, "Oh, yeah, the guy's going to write a book." And at the time, I was wearing these shoes called Five Fingers. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're not real shoes. You just slip them on and you can see your five toes.
I've seen those.
Yeah. And it looked really funny.
And you show up wearing these shoes, Carson?
And I show up wearing these shoes. And so I really started following the team. You know, I followed them a little bit loosely through the summer, mainly got to know Coach Klink. I went to some functions, but October 15th for me is like Christmas Day. That's when the official basketball season starts. So I started showing up on my lunch break at work with my notebook. And I started taking notes, and I was there every single day. I went to every function, and I got to know the guys. I interviewed all of them. And slowly but surely, they were getting to know me. And the breaking point was when we went to the University of Arizona to play an exhibition game. And that was such a big deal. I had handicapped that game for 5 months. And, you know, I was at that point, I became a tourist, you know, and it was such a thrill. And before every game, Coach Klink and the team, they have a half-court shot. So here we are at the University of Arizona. I'm this little geeky guy with his glasses on scribbling, and they all took a shot at the half-court, University of Arizona. Announcers are there, cameras are there, and they all missed it. Coach Klink will probably not like this, but I don't even think he hit the rim. So anyway, they're all
everybody's up there taking their turn at the shot, taking their turn.
They all missed. right? So they're finally like, oh, let's see if the writer can take a shot. And my basketball nickname is Mississippi Flash. So sure enough, I go out there. I take off my glasses. I dribble the ball between my legs a few times.
Ooh.
I launched a half-court shot. Nothing but net. And it's pretty cool because if you go on my website, you can actually see that half-court shot. And the team went nuts.
Well, now, you might explain when you say nothing but net. You don't mean it just swished the bottom of the net.
It was
right through the hoop.
Yes, it's what we call, dating myself, string music. I made it, and I had credibility. And at that point, I was in. And I just got to know them, and I was just kind of there all the time, you know?
So you are making notes, and this book that you ended up writing, Carson, I mean, when I lifted this book, I thought, gosh, I counted 506 pages, actually, including the Roman numerals at the start. A 506-page book about just one basketball team?
Hmm.
But I found that it was the stories of the people that captured my attention. I mean, it is about basketball, but it's about these young men's lives.
Right.
And about the coach's life. And so I found myself getting caught up in their stories. And did you find that they were willing to open up to you and say, yeah, this is what I was like before I got here?
Yes, it was a little bit difficult at first, but the more that I hung out, the more that they were able to open up and see that I was also writing this from the heart and had such a love for basketball and also for student athletes. And also kind of what you mentioned about how it's about these players, what I wanted to do is I wanted to write the basketball version of Friday Night Lights and, you know, like capturing the photography in the small town. And I just felt so much in love with the idea that you've got these really talented guys and they're going down to places like L.A. and playing in front of 180 people. And I had to figure out, how do you get up for that? And then it's just I realized it was the honest to God character of these young men, but through their character, I found that it went back to their grandparents and their home lives and Robert Duncan, who learned how to cut his teeth in Memphis.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about him because you said Robert Duncan's he averaged 1.9 seconds per game. He wasn't playing a lot. 2 seconds a game he played? And you say that inspired this book.
Yeah, Nancy, it was those 2 seconds. I went with my father-in-law. I didn't want to see a Division II basketball game. I'm too good for that, right? And I saw flashes of Pistol Pete. And the way that Robert...
Explain who Pistol Pete is.
Okay, so Pistol Pete Maravich was the greatest, I'm one of the greatest college basketball players of all time. It was the way that he could see things that no one else could see, and it was the way that he moved off the ball and could score. And I saw images of that in this Division II player. And I remarked to my father-in-law, I said, look at this church ball player. And 1.9 seconds later, I had to write a book. I was so blown away by it. And his character in the season that I follow the team, I mean, in fact, I'm so glad you mentioned Robert because he, I think, is such an inspiration in the book because he's the guy that all the other guys talk about as Robert, nobody knew about him. And a year later, he's the player of the year. That good, but an even better human being. For all the talent that these kids have, they're better people. You know, it was so refreshing.
Well, now you mentioned being inspired when you saw Pete Maravich play.
Yeah.
And I understood that because I flash back to when I was a kid and first saw, saw Pancho Gonzalez play tennis.
Oh, yes.
And from that moment, my imagination was captured by tennis. I played in high school. I played in college. I even had a tennis shop.
Oh.
And I was such a fan. People in college thought that was my major.
Really?
Because, and it dates back to seeing that match with Pancho Gonzalez and Ken Rosewall and being inspired by tennis. So I can understand you're seeing a basketball game with Pete Maravich and thinking, boy, that's for me.
Yes, greatness. Right.
My guest is Carson Medley, and his book is Through the Red Door. And one of the young men in your book had an injury, and it took him to using yoga to therapy to recover from his injury. And I thought back to, it was probably about 22 or 3 years ago, I was teaching a noon yoga class, and there was this tall, slender man who would come to this class drenched. And in fact, it was probably several years before I ever saw him with his hair dry.
Uh-huh.
because he would play basketball. Oh. I mean, I didn't know at first why he was drenching wet. Found out later. He would play basketball. He would come to my noon yoga class. And some years later, I hired him to teach yoga on my staff at Chico Sports Club. So imagine my delight when I read in your book about one of these men on the team that that took yoga with Rex Stromness.
Oh, that's your guy you're talking about.
So Rex Stromness used to come to my yoga classes before he started teaching himself. And tall, slender guy. So I have never seen him play basketball, but I've seen him do yoga. And it's a beauty to watch. So I can just imagine what a graceful basketball player he must have been back in those days when he was playing. So tell us about Rex Stromness.
I don't know Rex.
But you know the basketball player who worked with Rex.
Well, yeah, yes. What I do know about Rex and what I do know about the basketball player and being on this show with you is that everything about this book has somehow been about fate and yoga and just being in the right place at the right time. So the story of Jesse Holmes is who you're referring to.
Yes.
Is I remember reading in the newspaper the day when I decided to write this book 3 years ago that Jesse Holmes had committed to Chico State. And sports fans probably remember Jesse as he was one of the most prolific wide receivers in maybe Chico history, particularly at Chico High. So Coach Klink had been after him to play.
To play basketball.
But how could you turn down, you know, he's a football star. So he goes off to the Air Force Academy and fulfills that dream, playing on TV and, you know, but it was a pull for him. So as you read in the story, it's,
He suffered an injury. He was, you say he planned to play football at the Powerhouse Butte College where Aaron Rodgers played football. But he suffered an injury. We're talking about Holmes now. Part of his rehabilitation was doing yoga with Rex Stromness, the Chico State basketball team's yoga instructor. And it was due to Rex that Coach Klink discovered that young man Holmes was back in town. You say Rex casually mentioned to Coach Klink one day that Holmes was back in town and said he wanted to play basketball at Chico State.
Yeah.
And you said Coach Klink had no idea that Holmes was back in town, but ask Rex to have Holmes get in touch with
him. Yes, that's how it happened. His story is touching because you read about his brother, Casey.
Oh, my gosh. As we read along the story of this young man, and he has plans for himself, and then you start talking about his older brother, and I thought, oh, no, his brother went in the military.
Yep. And, you know, he was killed in just a kind of a freak accident.
Yeah.
And they were both such Chico High, everybody in Chico knew them. So part of Jesse's injury was also that mental injury of, oh, my God, what have I done? I'm here at Air Force. I'm playing football, but I'm looking on YouTube pictures of, you know, I'm looking at pictures of Bidwell Park and I miss my family. So he did get injured and then comes back. And that's why it's sort of this Joseph Campbell hero's journey where he comes back and just by mentioning to Rex that I'd love to play ball, they get connected because I think Jesse, as he tells it, and Jesse, I'm sorry if I don't get it correctly right, but he felt a little guilty for not playing for Coach Klink because this was his high school. He played right down the street. And talking about second chances in life, forget about what Fitzgerald said about not having a second act. He came back and had a second act. And another interesting thing about Jesse, he's no longer on the team because he's taking, I think he was offered a full ride scholarship. Yes, but this to graduate school if he took 5 classes this semester. And he chose academics over basketball. So if you're wondering where Jesse is now. But yeah, it goes back to Rex. I wouldn't have this chapter if Rex hadn't been doing yoga with him.
And I don't know if you knew he was a basketball player himself. As you might imagine,
I did not know.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that he started thinking about Chico and where he'd grown up. And you include a few pages about the town of Chico.
Yeah.
And I thought, I want to take this to friends and family who don't know Chico and explain why I love this place so much.
Mm, thank you.
And I know people who've lived in Chico, maybe they were students, they go to the Bay Area, And they get so used to the kindness, maybe is the word, of people in this community. And they go to the Bay Area and people are under such stress, they really miss the atmosphere of Chico.
Yes.
And so many of us who are here by choice. I know physicians, I know you are here by choice, coaches, and you have several pages describing the charm, if I want to call it that, of Chico. You want to just give us a little bit of what you explain why Chico itself is an attraction for players?
Yeah. I'll kind of talk about why it's an attraction for me first and then why I think it's for players. But I think I've felt exiled from Mississippi for I left home when I was 18, and it wasn't until I was 38 years old after living in California for 20 years when I came to Chico with Julia, my wife. We weren't married at the time, but I realized it was the closest thing to the South, but in a better way than I'd ever seen. There's the river culture. There's a university. People are friendly. Some people even talk like that, you know? And for me, it was that small town. It's a place where, after living in cities for a while, a lot of our players come from bigger areas. It's a kind of a place where you almost have to be nice to someone because you're going to see them again, guaranteed. And I just found authenticity in that. And I think for a lot of the guys that I interviewed, you know, coming to Chico just has, one, basketball is like next to baseball. It's one of the biggest games in town. We don't have football. And they're sort of like, in a way, like small town celebrities.
When coaches are recruiting, so that's a plus.
Yes.
Where they're going to be living in this wonderful community. However, and maybe it didn't bother the young men themselves, but their family, their grandfather or parents come, and you take them down certain neighborhoods in Chico where the fraternities are, and the parents get a view of, oh my goodness, now I see this was the number one party school named by Playboy at one point.
Right.
So how does that play with the parents?
Are you referring to the Robert Duncan story?
Yes.
Okay. Can I tell that story?
Yes.
So to answer that question, Nancy, there's the story of the recruitment of Robert Duncan, who was like one of the greatest Chico State basketball players ever. Well, when he came on a recruiting visit with his grandfather, who's retired military, everything was going great, and Coach Klink, and I think it was Coach Cobb at the time, were like, we've got him. And they took a turn, and they went down in the party area that you're talking about, and Granddad saw some women up on the roof, and he saw some guys playing ping pong, and you know, it's the swimming pools and people running around. And Coach Klink looked at his assistant and said, "We just lost Robert Duncan." And sure enough, Granddad was like, "You ain't going to Chico State." So he also, Robert, went to the Air Force Preparatory Academy for a year. And a year later, he got a Facebook message and a text to Coach Klink, and they're like, "He's back." But yeah, you're exactly right. And I think Coach Klink sells it as it's a place that kind of makes you become social. Yeah, because it's such a friendly place. But he doesn't mask the party thing either.
My guest is Carson Medley, and he has written a book about the year he spent observing the Chico State basketball team, Division II. And the title of his book is Through the Red Door. We're going to take a short break, then continue our conversation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Now, often a name comes up that I'm familiar with because Indiana University is, I got my master's degree there, and there was a coach there that, I'm going to say infamous, not just famous. First of all, Indiana is just nuts about basketball.
Yes.
And I happened to have been an academic advisor while I was there, and one of our the people on our staff was assigned to keep Coach Bobby Knight's players in good standing academically. I think you had Coach Klink kick a ball into the stands, kick a basketball. And then I remembered how Bobby Knight was seen throwing chairs. So I wondered if Bobby Knight was feared, because you say that Coach Klink wants to be loved, not feared.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's funny. That's another reason why I had to write this book, because I used to love Bobby Knight until I learned more about Bobby Knight. And as a coach, I still really respect him. But Bob Knight was about, as you just pointed out, fear and yelling. And if you've read the book, John Feinstein's A Season on the Brink, I wanted to write the Division II version of that, which followed Bobby Knight around for a year in 1983. And I saw in Coach Klink the antithesis, the complete opposite of Bob Knight, where instead of wanting to be feared in this Machiavellian way, he actually kind of wanted to be loved. And I mentioned him in the book as sort of this Old Testament, New Testament kind of father figure, where he can hurl lightning bolts. And every year, from what I hear, he kicks a ball into the stands. But that's about as bad as I got. You know, he didn't berate the players. He didn't throw chairs. He was just, he would yell, but I realized that coaches yell because it's hard to hear. But nothing that was like Bobby Knight. And it's funny you mention Knight, because Coach Klink does use some of Knight's philosophies called the power of negative thinking. So, yeah, I just saw the complete opposite. More of a Coach K from Duke University is how I saw Coach Klink and why I wanted to write this book, because I thought our guys were like the Division II version of Duke University. And I stand by that.
Well, another thing that your book helped me understand in this process of recruitment and the coach, because I had a couple of nieces that had scholarships, for diving scholarships, when they went to college. And the older one actually went to Olympic trials. And when colleges were wanting her to come to offer a scholarship, one was Harvard, one was Stanford. I thought, oh, great, good, strong academic schools. She did not choose either of those schools. She chose a school where the coach was the coach she wanted to work with. And at the time, I thought, oh, golly, is that so important? But right. Now reading your book, I realize absolutely. Yep. The coach is so important because they spend so much time of their college life with that coach. So thank you, Carson.
Yeah, you bet. How did she turn out?
Oh, she academically was strong, as you might suspect, and she ended up marrying somebody on the swim team.
Oh, there you go.
And
awesome.
They have two little ones now. Well, you often refer to the noon cats in your book, and that you're one of those noon cats. Who are the noon cats?
The noon cats. So, got to give a shout out to the noon cats. So, basically, we're all men in the between the ages of, I would say, if you're under 35, we kind of look down our nose at you. But, you know, we're faculty, staff, you name it, administrators, everyone across the board between the ages, I would say, 38 and 65. 68, I think, was our oldest player, who meet every Tuesday and Thursday between 12 and 1 in Shermer Gym, which is like 500 years old, before Naismith did the peach basket thing. And we just get after it, and we play ball. And Coach Klink and the assistant coaches come out, and everyone's on better behavior then. But we're just older guys that love the game and can't give it up. And we go at it.
Well, now you mentioned that Coach Klink joins you in these games. And so maybe we should just let people know about Coach Klink. You say he does not blend well on campus. And why do you say that, Carson?
Well, he's kind of he's kind of looks like he's maybe too young to be a professor, but he's not. It's like, where does he fit in?
People see him walk across campus. Well, who is that guy? Because he's too young and athletic to be a professor.
Yeah.
He's a little too old to be a student. And then you say, and way too happy to be an administrator.
Thank you. That's where I was going with that. I didn't want to say it in case people at the university are listening. But yeah, you just don't really know who he is when you first meet him. You know, and I kind of describe him in the book. He's sort of he's a handsome kind of character that you might see in one of those film noir, like, you know, like the black and white. Who am I going for here? Humphrey Bogart type things, you know, but he's just not what you'd expect a basketball coach to be like.
Well, you also mentioned, because I have used the word inspirational to describe this coach, but you also say, not only before he even became a coach, that in 1993, he was voted most inspirational player.
Yes. Yeah. So that backstory is great because, as you probably know, his coach was Puck Smith at the time, whom he would later come back and replace and who was his mentor. And he accredits everything back to Puck Smith. But when he was playing for Puck, Coach Klink, he was a bench player. He didn't play. I think he played maybe 8 or 9 games his senior year, and he just didn't play. But he was inspirational for the same reason, the same thing that he tells his guys. He's like, I want you guys, he calls them the black shirts in practice because they work so hard, but they just don't get a lot of playing time. He's like, you guys on the bench need to be active. So he makes sure that the guys on the bench are actually engaged in the game. And I think that's what makes him such a great coach and leader and has taken away any hubris and made him humble because he knows what it's like to be on the bench. But I think from doing that, he became such a good coach because it forced him to kind of be a student of the game. And did you get to the part where he applied for his job interview and he ripped open his shirt and he had the championship? Yeah. So anyway, and it's just full circle how he came back and now he's teaching where he wrote, or he's coaching where he once rode the bench and replaced his mentor.
Well, I would like to get a little more specific about why is this man, why does he inspire loyalty, maybe is the word, in his players? What makes him so inspirational? Why is he a good, is he a good leader?
Yeah, he's a great leader. It's one, he's transparent. That's what I observed through my year of getting to know him. And as he's, you know, he, as I think I described in the book, he's the kind of guy, and everyone said this about him, that would march through fire for him if he said, let's go. And what I discovered about Coach Klink is it's pretty, a pretty simple philosophy where he's like, I hate to use a cliche, but he walks the walk and he talks the talk. It's integrity. And he doesn't do anything that he wouldn't want his players to do. And he's just always exhibiting that right kind of behavior.
Some of the things you mentioned in your book, you say he points out he must always practice what he preaches.
Yes.
You have to always be on time. You have to always put forth your best effort, consistency. A lot of coaches stress character and punctuality in their players, but they themselves don't live up to it. And then he also believes a good leader has to enforce consequences for not acting in accordance with the rules.
Yes.
And you say every man is accountable.
Yes. And he holds his players accountable. A great example, and I think for me it was the most touching part of the book and the hardest to write, was the unscripted drama of when one of his players became academically ineligible. It was a senior that came as a redshirt freshman, but he didn't get his grades, and he didn't get to participate in senior night. This player had to cancel, I think his family had 30 flights that they had to cancel, but those were the consequences. The senior didn't get his grades. And being in the locker room and seeing that moment, and Klink was behind the player, had his hands on him, and they were both in tears, and it killed him. Not to let him go out, not playing was one thing, but not to get his bouquet of flowers and be congratulated on senior night. But that's the kind of guy that I discovered in Klink, accountability.
Well, here's from your book. I learned that you can try and do all the right things as a leader. This is Coach Klink now saying. But if you don't have the right people following you, then it's not going to work no matter how hard you try. You have to assemble a team of people that'll buy into the vision, people that want to give themselves to something special and be part of something bigger than themselves. So if he's building a team of people like this, he can't do that right when he steps in the door and takes over being coach, because he's got these players that may not be with the program.
Right.
So I think you make this point in your book that it takes him a while to build, to select these kind of young men.
Correct. When I started writing the book, I was in the concession stand and I heard a Dominguez Hills fan say, "What's that special sauce those folks are drinking in Chico?" That's the special sauce, is he picks the right student athletes that come from homes that emphasize academics, that emphasize being a good person, integrity, and character. And that's who he builds his program with, not with the best player he can get his hands on. And they're just good quality young men. And as he says, I don't pick any young man that I wouldn't allow to babysit my sons or to watch his sons are older now, but to be alone with my sons.
Well, it's been a pleasure reading your book, Carson.
Thank you.
And I think people will enjoy the stories that you have in your book. Remind people again, the title of your book is Through the Red Door, and the subtitle is The Eternal Season of Coach Klink and the Division II Chico State Wildcats. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshop on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.